So welcome again, and thank you for coming to the afternoon session. And no slides for this one, just a discussion and conversation about addiction, and we can go in any direction we want. I titled it as the treatment of other substance use disorders because we touched on opioids in the big lecture, but we certainly can talk more about opioid treatments and, of course, the other substance use disorders. And also we can talk about co-occurring disorders if you have an interest with other psychiatric disorders. I think we're all set. How many people here do primarily mental health, would you say? Oh, no, okay. All right, okay, none. All right. Okay, that's good. But I'm sure you see a lot of mental health issues no matter where you you practice and whatever you do. So I'll be more than happy to cover those. So let's just kind of talk a little bit about the bigger picture of addiction. The primary treatment of addiction in 2017 continues to be primarily psychosocial. Individual psychotherapy, group psychotherapy, counseling, halfway homes, partial hospitalization, intensive outpatient programs. These are the things that really get people better. But this being said, we do now have some safe and effective medications that also help in the treatment of addiction. The way that I think about medications in the treatment of addiction is, first of all, let's put aside all the medications that treat co-occurring psychiatric disorders or medical disorders. Of course, you have antihypertensives, of course, you have antipsychotics, and you have antidepressants that you treat addicted patients with for co-occurring medical and psychiatric disorders. But aside from this, the medications that directly address the addiction are not really all that many. As a matter of fact, they're all summarized in this one page. These are all the substance use, the FDA-approved substance use medications. And also I added one, which is not FDA-approved, but has a very good chance of being, and it's almost there, and that's topiramate. But pretty much everything else is FDA-approved, and the only ones that are FDA-approved. The way I've constructed this table here is in four columns and three rows, and the columns are the major classes of drugs of abuse. So we have tobacco, the sedatives, essentially alcohol and benzodiazepines, then we have the opioids, and then we have stimulants, primarily cocaine and crystal methamphetamine. And then the three rows are the three clinical scenarios that you can find your patient in, either in acute, acute intoxication, in acute withdrawal, or in the long run. What kind of medications do we have available to treat patients in the long run? If anybody has any questions about the hyperacute setting of intoxication and withdrawal, I'll be more than happy to talk about them. But I want to spend most of our time on the third slab, the third category, which is medications that we provide our patients for treatment in the long run, how to keep them safe, how to keep them sober in the long run. Okay? Now, in that space, in the space of medications that directly address the addiction in the long run, I further break down the way I think about medications in three categories. There are some addictions for which we have done well, pharmacologically speaking, some where we've done so-so, and some where our record is totally pathetic. Okay? What are the addictions for which we have done well psychopharmacologically? Opioids, absolutely. And tobacco. The politically correct term in 2017 is tobacco instead of nicotine. I couldn't care less. Nicotine, tobacco, same thing for me. But the people who do work so much with the tobacco use disorder want to make the distinction between nicotine as in terms of nicotine replacement therapies, and nicotine replacement therapies are good things, so they want to say that tobacco is the bad thing. So that's how they make the distinction there. It goes back and forth. I don't think so, because when we talk about opioids is everything, both the good and the bad stuff. Anyway, so opioids and tobacco absolutely are the success stories. What would you put in the so-so category? Alcohol, absolutely. And the empathetics is really the stimulant, and cannabis, and the behavioral addictions. Gambling, sex, and the internet. So this arrangement here has clinical implications in the following way. Patient comes in and says, No. I've seen your lecture or whatever. I know that the combination of medication with psychosocial supports gives you the best results and maximizes the gap between the hijacked pleasure reward pathways and the frontal lobes and the like. But trust me, I hate hard chairs. I hate meetings. I'm never going to go to AA. I'm never going to go to counseling. Just give me my nice pill. Send me my merry way, and I'll be just fine. There are a bunch of patients like this. Question for us is it ethical to prescribe the medication for them? And the analogy that from the medical world that's very often popped is the woman with a fungating breast mass who comes to you and says, I don't want to see the surgeon, I'm never going to have surgery, just give him my antibiotics to cool down the infection and I'll be just fine. And of course, if you write the antibiotics, you're colluding with someone in a treatment that is headed for disaster. Right? Because the woman obviously needs to go and see the surgeon. So in a similar fashion, in addiction medicine, when we write a medication that has very little chance of success, if any, are we colluding with a patient in some kind of disastrous course? And I suggest to you, go ahead.
Well, I have a question about this, and I don't know the literature, so I'm not 100% certain this is right, but I've heard that the evidence base behind AA is extremely poor.
No. Not true.
Not true.
Not true. No, that's absolutely not true. It's done a wonderful job. Now we do have evidence, Mark Gallanter's research. Koskoutas has written a bunch of articles on it, and we do have some very hard evidence about how wonderful AA can be, especially for alcohol, but quite possibly for other drugs of abuse as well. Not for everybody. Not for everybody. There are people who will not take to AA, and we do have alternatives for them. Okay, so back to the question of whether you prescribe the medication or not, I think that you have to add the level of sophistication to that question, and that is, what addiction are we talking about? If you're talking about tobacco and opioids, the answer is yes. Prescribe the buprenorphine, prescribe the varenicline, slap that nicotine patch on the person. Yes, they would have even higher chance of success if they did the psychosocial supports, but the power of the medication is so strong that it can carry a lot of burden on its shoulder, and really the patient has a fighting chance of success even without the psychosocial supports. True for both tobacco and opioids. Contrast that with alcohol. There is not a shred of evidence that acamprosate, naltrexone, or disulfiram will do anything for your patient unless she or he also has some kind of psychosocial support. Under some extreme circumstances, I may still give them the medication in order to preserve the rapport that I have with the patient and the relationship that I have with the patient and keep them in treatment, but by no means in my mind I have high hopes that this is going to really work for my patient in the absence of psychosocial supports. And when we get to here, would be really experimental, all the way perhaps to criminal, to start prescribing, I don't know, stimulants for cocaine and whatever else you may think may be a good idea, when there's no evidence whatsoever that these medications will do anything for your patient. So stratification of the power of medication is helpful when it comes to addiction medicine. All right. With that in mind, I have concocted a little 10-case exam or test or quiz or exercise, whatever we want to call it, on the third page here. And we can go through that and then discuss things as we go along. But before doing that, any questions that you have from the lecture this morning or from what we just discussed, go ahead. I can repeat the questions too. Go ahead.
I have a question more about kind of tapering somebody off. So I have a question about tapering somebody off of benzodiazepines. Like, a lot of people that come in from elsewhere that are on, some people on very high doses, and they either don't pass a UA or you have some other issues where you really, they shouldn't be on these medications anymore.
Yeah.
So this is saying like 25% Q day. I didn't know what your kind of tapering regimen would be for somebody on the high dose for a long period of time.
What we do is, first of all, we switch. You go to all these tables. They're everywhere. Of the equivalencies of different benzodiazepines. So you calculate how much, kind of the same thing as the morphine and milliequivalent, same idea. So you look at alprazolam and diazepam and lorazepam and clonazepam, whatever the patient has, and you calculate what would be the equivalent clonazepam dose. And you start them on that dose and you stop all the other medications. We used to say you go 50% of clonazepam of whatever else they are taking. Not a good idea, because usually it's not enough, and the patient either seizes or just relapses. So we do 100% now of whatever they are taking, and then we start the clonazepam tapering down little by little. The general idea in pretty much all of addiction medicine, but certainly for benzodiazepines, is the longer the taper, the greater the chance of success. The longer the taper, the greater the chance of success, unless your patient has a particular reason why they want to go quickly. Like they want to become pregnant, or they want to join the military, or they have some kind of a professional driving license that is, or they go overseas, or something that pressures them to do a quicker taper. Take your time, 6 months, whatever it takes, little by little by little by little by little by little by little, and then you taper them off. Go ahead.
To the beginning of your talk was patients who may have had an underlying disorder to begin with, either a mental health disorder or a chronic pain disorder that started all these things off. And so there's, I think, oftentimes still that psychological dependence base rooted in that. Yeah. I originally had a problem. I still need that problem addressed.
Absolutely.
And I was curious how you kind of work towards establishing.
And there is a difference there between pain and, let's say, the psychiatric disorders. Very often the pain problems do go away, especially, you know, if they're resulting from an accident or so on. So you truly, the patient does not need the medication, at which point, you know, it's a different story. But with psychiatric disorders, depression and anxiety, quite often the patient does need the medications, and we have to give it to them. Just one general thing about benzodiazepines and depression. When I went to medical school, the algorithm was for depression, we give antidepressants. For anxiety, you give anxiolytics, like benzodiazepines. Now, this algorithm has been thrown out completely, completely, completely. And for depression, we give antidepressants. For anxiety, we give antidepressants. Antidepressants are the first-line treatment for pretty much all anxiety disorders. And if you think about depression being preoccupation about the past, anxiety being preoccupation about the future, they both go through similar mechanisms, they both involve the serotonin system, and they both seem to respond to similar agents, particularly SSRIs and SNRIs. So that's what we do, and certainly we address those underlying conditions. Yeah?
You have any special approach to, like, patients that are misusing, for example, Suboxone, or like injecting Suboxone?
Yeah, certainly give the combination product, which is four parts buprenorphine, one part naloxone, instead of the mono product, which is all buprenorphine. It makes it less likely to be abused. There are still some people who do inject buprenorphine. There are not that many. Primarily, they do it when they run out of the good stuff. For example, if they're used to shoot heroin and their drug dealer goes to Florida for a vacation and they run out, then they may be able to find some kind of buprenorphine somewhere else in order to inject it. We don't see that much injected buprenorphine naloxone combination, but it does exist. And then, of course, that's where the psychosocial side of addiction treatment very much comes in, and you deploy your whole motivational interviewing, CBT groups, whatever you have to help the patient with that. It's also another indication that perhaps the patient needs to go to methadone. Maybe they need the full agonist effect of methadone, and that's a possibility. Or maybe going to naltrexone, either oral or injectable. Kind of you treat it as a medication failure if you're pretty sure that that's what's happening. Go ahead. We're doing general questions. There are more than I expected, but that's cool. That's okay. I can deal with that. And then I will go to the quiz. Go ahead.
A lot of my patients get prescribed off-label gabapentin, a lot of times for crystal methamphetamine, sometimes for cannabis, sometimes for other substances. Would you talk about that?
Yeah. Sore subject for me and for a lot of people, gabapentin. Why? Because we did a bunch of studies in New York like 15, 20 years ago at Beth Israel and found gabapentin to be extremely helpful for acute detoxification from alcohol at higher doses and pretty helpful for the protracted withdrawal syndrome from alcohol. The more we study addiction, the more we appreciate the protracted withdrawal syndromes, and alcohol has a very, very significant one that can go up for months. Gabapentin seemed to be very helpful on both sides, the acute withdrawal and protracted withdrawal. So you can very nicely start somebody on higher doses of gabapentin and then taper them to lower doses of gabapentin. The problem is that the company that makes gabapentin never really wanted to go after the indication for any substance use disorders, yet there is significant evidence of success with gabapentin. So we're hoping that at some point it will go through the regular channels and will become FDA approved. Mostly because now we are tied to giving benzodiazepines for the treatment of acute alcohol withdrawal and sedative withdrawal, which of course have their own addictive potential. It would be wonderful to be able to do gabapentin. All this being said, I wouldn't recommend for you to wholesale start gabapentin because it's not just that it doesn't have the FDA approval. It's also nursing staff is not quite familiar with it in inpatient settings the same way that they are with the benzodiazepines. There's much more opportunity for missed significant withdrawal. It's just not part of the fiber of how we do alcohol withdrawal in 2017. You seem to be perplexed by that, the last part.
I work in a homeless shelter.
Ah, okay.
So it's basically a lot of underpinned alcoholics. And it's common for people, like, they go through alcohol withdrawal when they sleep. Yeah. I explain that to them. Will you please give me a sleeping pill? No.
Yeah. Well, we love gabapentin. It does have direct effects on anxiety, irritability, insomnia, restlessness, all these things. And it also does work quite beautifully as a placebo medication. I mean, 100 milligrams of gabapentin haven't killed anybody. And the milligrams are big also, 300 milligrams. It's not like one of those puny 1 milligram of risperidone that you're giving. You're giving 300 milligrams. It's like a big dose for a lot of patients, and give it three times a day. And just like it has much more of a gabapentin, even just that, you know. and it does help some. So, okay, all right, we'll do 1, 2, 3, 4, and then we'll go to the things. Okay, go ahead.
There's a local psychiatrist in Southwest Florida that believes gabapentin is a very good treatment for anxiety, and he uses it at rather large doses.
Okay.
Comment?
This starts becoming psychopharmacology 201 or 301. Yes, there is this debate. There are these kind of ideas. When I asked here how many people work with mental health or how many people are psychiatrists, not a single hand went up. So I'm going to just try to stay away from like the super cutting edge, very controversial, last minute kind of things. But I do agree. There are people who do believe that it's a good anxiolytic, and probably one of them as well. But it's not. We're not ready to go prime time with gabapentin for that. It does, but only at higher doses, and certainly much, much less so than benzodiazepines. All right, 2, 3, 4. Go ahead, 2.
So we practice up in Montana, and meth is our drug
meth
of choice.
Meth is methamphetamine.
Meth is methamphetamine, okay. Yep. So one of the services that we consult with consistently recommends mirtazapine for methamphetamine cravings.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if you can comment on that.
Yep. There are about 40 medications that have been tried for crystal methamphetamine, mirtazapine being one of them, gabapentin being another one. Modafinil was probably the one that bubbled up more than the other ones and had some kind of success. You can think about bupropion. You can think about atomoxetine. Atomoxetine, all these mild stimulants that can perhaps as a kind of a substitution treatment can help with crystal meth. Nothing at this point. Nothing that I can definitively say yes to that. Steve Lee from New York, who's done tons of work with crystal methamphetamine, does swear by bupropion, and he does use, you know, moderate doses of bupropion, like about 150 milligrams or so for patients. Go ahead.
Yeah, one of the first things you talked about was using using a medication on people who did not want the psychosocial follow-up. And our organization is a little schizophrenic. We have like a pure psych wing, we have an addiction wing, and then we have the medical people.
Okay.
The pure psych people, I have a pretty low tolerance for SSR, for giving people SSRIs.
Okay.
And the pure psych...
You have low tolerance for giving, meaning you give them easily?
Fairly easily. Yes, okay. Yes, okay. Yes. Right. I'm pretty willing to, you know, take a shot at, you know, SSRIs because they're freaking so effective, low risk.
Okay.
But the psych people think that we shouldn't give any psychoactive drugs at all to people who won't follow up, and they're sort of like, you know, a tough love kind of organization. They want, if they don't follow up, they think we should stop the scripts. And I'm just, my population is tough, you know. Right. They don't follow through well. And
all right, here's how it goes, or I think it goes. All right. Here's like the whole thing about dual diagnosis. You can think about a spectrum. Ooh, that's kind of, it wasn't meant to be. All right, something like that. So here on one end, put mental illness secondary to addiction. And here you put addiction secondary to mental illness. Okay? So what do we have here? Here we have classic situation. You're an alcoholic, and you develop depression because of your alcoholism, and you now have both depression and alcoholism, right? Here you have addiction secondary to mental illness, and that's the classic self-medication situation where you suffer from anxiety or depression, and then you start using cocaine to self-medicate or alcohol to self-medicate, and you end up with both. But this is the two extremes, is what is really the major, the main mechanism, the main engine behind the patient's misery, problem. Somewhere here in the middle, you have true dual diagnosis, where you have both mental illness and addiction, right? Now, in recent years, this box of true dual diagnosis has been expanding on both sides. And pretty much everything is now considered to be dual diagnosis. Why? Primarily because of the safety of SSRIs. Back when we had tricyclic antidepressants and the like, we had to be very, very careful before we started prescribing. But now with the SSRIs and the SNRIs, we can do that rather easily. So anybody who falls between the two extremes of mental illness secondary to addiction, addiction secondary mental illness, ends up getting dual treatments. Treatment for the addiction and treatment for the mental illness. Okay? Now, this being said, if you are absolutely convinced that you are living in one of those two extremes, you can possibly get away with single treatment. If you are very, very sure that all your mental illness is secondary to your addiction, you can get away by treating the addiction and then hope that the mental illness will go away by itself. And it does happen. Similarly, over here, you can also can get away with single treatment. If you are absolutely convinced that all your addiction is secondary to mental illness, you can put all your efforts in treating the mental illness, and then the addiction will go away. But Practically, for the most part, when you identify phenomenologically, when you do meet criteria for both sides, chances are that you're going to end up giving treatment for both disorders. Fran Levin and Ned Nunes published a seminal article in JAMA about those two extremes, that it's possible and likely and a good idea to do single treatments, but it's really the extremes. Go ahead.
Could you address benzodiazepines and buprenorphine? It's the biggest problem I have with my buprenorphine people. I've even had people lie to me about their use of it, where they're getting it elsewhere, and I only found it through DOJ reports, and it's so difficult for them to give up. My understanding is there's only one real study from France that really showed a dangerous combination, and there's really been not much since to actually prove the damage.
Oh, what happened here? Absolutely, it doesn't matter. So absolutely, that whole mayhem started with a French study, where there were a series of deaths due to a combination of buprenorphine, monobuprenorphine. Buprenorphine comes in two forms, in just buprenorphine alone, and four parts of buprenorphine plus one part of naloxone. The naloxone part makes it very, very difficult to inject, because when you inject, the naloxone kicks in, is very, very powerful, and it sends you into withdrawal. If you use the medication as prescribed, sublingually, the body ignores the naloxone. So we pretty much give everybody the combination product, except in pregnancy. So that's what we do, okay? Now, in France, literally 20 years ago, or maybe even more, they had just the mono product. So some addicted patients would crush the tablets. They were not films back then. They were tablets. They crushed the tablets and inject them. Inject high-dose benzodiazepines on top and have some alcohol for good measure, at which point they depressed the respiratory system and died. It was really the impetus. It was the main reason why they made the combo product when the medication came to the United States. Since then, this whole idea of benzodiazepine and buprenorphine will not die, and we keep on like saying that it's rather safe. You wouldn't want to be the first person who loses a patient due to high-dose benzodiazepine and buprenorphine. But it doesn't happen. It really doesn't happen. There were some kind of sketchy situations in combination in Boston with neonates, but that's a completely different kind of picture. In adults, it doesn't happen. For us, actually, the main problem in my system is alcohol. Alcohol, heavy, heavy drinkers on buprenorphine. Do you stop the buprenorphine if somebody is drinking? Absolutely not.
So you continue
the buprenorphine. You certainly continue the buprenorphine.
With the benzo?
You don't prescribe the benzodiazepines. You try to get the person off benzodiazepines, but they may very well get benzodiazepines off the street.
Well, then why not prescribe it and then try to taper it?
Because you treat it like a drug of abuse. You treat it like cocaine. Of course I'm going to have you in my practice if you're using cocaine, but I'm not going to be supporting that. I'm going to do everything I can to get you off cocaine. But I'm not going to stop the buprenorphine because you're using cocaine. Similar idea with benzodiazepines. You don't endorse them. You try to taper them. You don't prescribe them, but you accept them. All right, quiz time. All right, everybody's favorite. And then I'm sure we'll go so quickly here that we'll have time for... Okay. Yeah, okay. Oh, you want... Yeah, okay. Yeah, sure. Let's go. Take mine. Is anybody else who doesn't have... it's the third page of this handout of yours. Here, I got it. Sure. And I like the color copies, no expense spared by the organization. Very good. Thank you. All right. Okay. So we're going to be asking for volunteers now to read the questions. Who's going to read that? Go ahead.
Frank says, I only want to drink two beers, like my frat buddy John, but once I start drinking, I can't stop, and before I know it, have downed a six-pack.
Okay, so this quiz here is a one-to-one situation where you have 10 options at the bottom, and let's say it's a very forced imaginary situation where you cannot use a combination of medication. You have to choose only one for this for Frank. Which one would you use? Which one?
Can you repeat it between?
You cannot repeat it once and only once. It's a one-to-one matching. Make it easier. You're not going to start with J. We're going to keep the J for something that really, really, really you don't have any medication. for something that we have a little bit of something, let's try something here.
Maybe naltrexone?
Maybe naltrexone, absolutely. Naltrexone is the right answer here. Okay, let me try to explain a couple of other things here. All right, I'm going to blow my last paper here.
No, I think you can
it's too much work. All right. But we may have to get to that. Okay. There are two types of cravings for alcohol. Terrible names, but here they are. They are called abstinence cravings and reward cravings. Okay. Of course, most alcoholic patients have a combination of both, but let's try to just see where our patient lands. Is it mostly reward cravings, personal or abstinence cravings? Okay. If this is some kind of depiction of being normal, okay, reward cravings have to do with getting high. It's a dopaminergic system. And what happens is you drink. Oh, perfect. Thank you. Okay, to the rescue, in case we need it. You put it down there. So you're perfectly fine. You're normal. You're good. And then you start having a few drinks. And then your dopamine system starts going haywire. And you have this positive feedback mechanism where you get more and more and more and more excited. And before you know it, you're drunk. There's reward craving. The escalating, kind of recurring, rewarding, positive feedback-like mechanism of your cravings. Okay? That's one type. The other one, the abstinence cravings, is not that you're craving abstinence. You're craving alcohol in order to avoid an abstinence syndrome, which is an outdated term for a withdrawal syndrome. Let me say it again. An abstinence craving is the craving that you have for alcohol to stave off withdrawal. I mentioned earlier the protracted withdrawal syndrome characterized by anxiety, insomnia, restlessness, malaise, irritability, that kind of hell. So as you have stopped using and you feel all this kind of protracted withdrawal syndrome right here and you're very, very, very miserable, then you have the alcohol in order to normalize. Reward cravings, dopaminergic. Abstinence cravings, glutaminergic. Okay? A lot of our patients tend to be in one of the two sides. They have more of the reward cravings type of alcoholism, or they have more of the abstinence cravings type of alcoholism. Where do we think Frank falls? Reward, clearly. And the medication for reward cravings is naltrexone. Let's see how it works. It's a very clever mechanism of action. You drink, okay? You stop drinking, and let's say after you stop drinking, you don't start on any medications. 2 weeks later, you have a few drinks. Your opioid system has now reset. As you know, alcohol affects all kinds of neurotransmitter systems, including the opioid system. So your opioid system has now reset. You have a couple of beers, and then both your opioid and the dopaminergic system start going haywire, and boom, 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 boom. You get plastered, you get totally drunk, and you relapse. Scenario number two. You drink. You stop drinking. And the day after you stop drinking, you put yourself on naltrexone, either oral 50 milligrams a day or injectable in the gluteal muscle 380 milligrams a month. So you start on naltrexone. And 2 weeks later, you have a couple of beers. Your opioid system is now blocked with an naltrexone. And yes, you're going to get high, but you're not going to get nearly as high as you would without the naltrexone protection. So you end up being somewhere here. So what that does is it gives you a little more of a chance of saying, what am I doing here? Do I want to go back to this life of drinking? Or perhaps I can go to a meeting, or I can call my sponsor, or I can call my doctor, or can do something to go back to my sobriety. So in a very, very clever fashion, what naltrexone does for alcoholism, it does not really target the first set of drinks after a period of abstinence. It really targets the second set of drinks after a period of abstinence. Essentially, what naltrexone says is, okay, you may have some beers here and there. What I'm going to do for you is I'm going to rob you from the real, really big high, and therefore making it a little more reasonable for you to go back to your sobriety. A very clever mechanism of action. A much more complex than, let's say, naltrexone for opioids. And that's a classic situation that we see with Frank here, right? Okay, go ahead.
What about people for whom sobriety may not be their goal, but moderation is?
That is exactly the situation with naltrexone. Is that it occasionally allows these outbursts of alcohol, but they are not so exciting, so it gives you more of a chance of keeping it there.
And medically, that's an acceptable goal?
It depends.
Even if it's long-term.
I mean, if we want to go on the whole idea of harm reduction versus... First of all, harm reduction is a terrible term for us in addiction treatment because everything under the sun is harm reduction. It's like all of medicine is about reducing harm. It has become something like world peace. It's like one of those kind of meaningless things that, of course, we all come from a harm reduction perspective. What does have meaning for us in addiction medicine is moderation management. Moderation management is a much more specific kind of way of whether you are for it or against it. And it does have to do with the severity of illness. For example, moderation management for crystal methamphetamine is insane. Nobody, even if you are the most left side of that spectrum of moderation management versus abstinence, you would support crystal methamphetamine moderation management. So it gets a little more complex. Okay, it's not going to happen if we go that slow, but we'll make it. All right, who's going to talk about Irene? Come on, go ahead. Somebody here. All right.
Ben Lefaxi?
No, wait. You have to read the story first.
Oh, sorry. Irene says, last time I got so down, I jumped into the Hudson River hoping to die. Now I'm just drinking myself to death.
Okay, and you suggest stay with you. You suggest Ben Lefaxi. Why?
Because it sounds to me like Irene is self-medicating her depression with alcohol and that an SNRI might be an effective treatment.
Correct. What I was going after here was the situation of this. I was going after the addiction secondary to mental illness, and it will be like at the very, very extreme here where she's just so depressed that she's jumping on the river, so we can throw all our efforts into her major depression, and then hopefully, you know, the alcoholism will get much better. Of course, remember from the morning lecture, once you hijack those pleasure-reward pathways of the brain, then chances are that you will need dual treatment. But this case, and there are some cases, were the very extreme of that spectrum here. Okay? All right, let's go to Eli or Ellie. You choose whatever you want. Just give the microphone to somebody and then you start talking. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Eli says, it's the strangest thing. I run around like crazy. I do a couple of lines of cocaine, and then I feel calm, relaxed, and focused. I was thinking maybe methylphenidate.
Absolutely.
Maybe the person has ADD.
Great idea. If right here we're to do some kind of cocaine, like a couple of lines of cocaine, each one of us, most of us would get high. We'd start talking a mile a minute. We'll feel like we're on top of the world. We become assholes. Just that kind of basic idea of cocaine, right? A small number of us, maybe 5% or less, would have a paradoxical effect, would have exactly the opposite, would feel calm, relaxed, focused. It was first identified by flight attendants when they realized that they can give coffee to hyperactive kids that they were bouncing up and down the aisles and cool them down. The paradoxical effect of stimulants for people who may suffer from ADHD. So Eli here certainly needs an evaluation for ADHD. By no means that this should be your diagnosis because of the cocaine. It's not pathognomonic for ADHD by any means, but it certainly bought himself an evaluation for ADHD. Go ahead. Yes, the stimulants in general. I mean, we would have the atomoxetine is you know always kind of a little bit of a milder stimulant, but bupropion, modafinil, atomoxetine, methylphenidate, amphetamines, methamphetamines, whatever you want to treat your ADHD with. All right, let's go to Betty. Okay, here. We'll go a different one. Sorry, this guy. She did one.
Betty say, I have been chewing up to six bags of heroin a day for the past few years, but now that I'm going to have a baby, I need to do something about it.
Okay.
The B.
Buprenorphine. Okay. Very good. Why do we do buprenorphine, not buprenorphine naloxone? Okay, it is contraindicated in pregnancy. That's correct. A lot of groups across the country are now saying that the risk of naloxone for the pregnant woman is so minimal that it's better to just go across the board combination product for everybody. But we're not there yet. So for medical legal purposes, I suggest to you that if your patient is pregnant, absolutely use the mono product. Now, the good news here is that the problems in pregnancy due to naloxone, the little problems that they exist are third trimester problems, placenta abruptio, premature labor, and the like. So that's nice. It doesn't have teratogenic effects. So you don't have to put all women of childbearing age to the mono product. You can give the combo product, the four parts buprenorphine, one part naloxone, across the board, and when you realize that a woman is pregnant, then you switch her milligram to milligram from the combo product to the mono product. Does that make sense? Now, of course, if a woman just got married, it's actively she wants to get pregnant, and you trust her that she's not going to be shooting up, then you may very well start right with the mono product from the beginning of the pregnancy. What happens is that naloxone does not have sublingual bioavailability. That's why when you use the combo product of buprenorphine and naloxone sublingually, the body sees buprenorphine and ignores naloxone. But in pregnancy, even the minute amounts of naloxone that do come through the sublingual route may be problematic. And that's why we have these kind of asterisks there that pregnant women should get the mono product. Okay. Next guy, next person. Go ahead. Gotcha. All right.
Unless I completely, completely stop smoking marijuana, she's going to take the kids and go back to her mother's. This time, it's for real.
Okay, what are we going to do for Jack?
No
meds. We'll do Jack for Jack. Yes, okay, that's right. No meds for cannabis. We tried dronabinol, synthetic tetrahydrocannabinol, as a replacement treatment. We did get better retention because everybody wanted to get the free cannabis. We saw no difference in the urine toxicology examinations. We're not there yet with the medications for cannabis. All right, let's do Harriet, the next one. Yeah, very good. Excellent. Thank you.
I recently switched to Marlboro Lights. Isn't that better?
Okay. What are we going to do for Harriet?
Say no.
Any idea? What is it? Yes, varenicline. Absolutely. First of all, is it better to the light cigarettes than the full force cigarettes?
No.
They are and they aren't. you knew something like that was happening. The way that they make, the traditional way of making light cigarettes is they freeze regular tobacco to very, very low temperatures, and then when tobacco comes back to room temperature, it pops like popcorn. So it occupies bigger space, and that's why they did in the cigarette. So it's exactly the same thing, only you get less cigarette per cigarette with the light cigarettes. So in some ways, you haven't made yourself. If you were smoking 20 cigarettes before the lights and 20 cigarettes with the lights, yes, you're doing yourself a little bit of a favor there. But if you end up smoking 30 because the 20 are not enough to keep the nicotine level, an acceptable level in your body, then it's not. So, varenicline, absolutely. How many people here use varenicline with your patients? Wow! Okay, awesome. That's great. Up until last year, 2016, we would say that we have three FDA-approved medications for tobacco. We have the whole group of nicotine replacement therapies. We have bupropion and we have varenicline. And depending on the patient and the situation, you may want to start with the nicotine replacement therapies because they are cheaper or they are more easily available and people know about them, blah, 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 blah. After a seminal study in 2016, meta-analysis, huge kind of, it's not a meta-analysis, but it was a multi-site study with many, many different groups. Varenicline emerged as the first-line treatment for tobacco cessation. So, wow, it's a wow moment. Yeah, we were very impressed with that. They did it with non-psychiatric patients. They did it with psychiatric patients. On both sides, it was much more helpful. Go ahead.
Is there a maximum time limit?
Yeah. That's an excellent question here. My father is a pulmonologist. He specializes in asthma. And, you know, he doesn't quite get it. We have conversations now. He says, back when I was in practice, I would tell my patients, quit smoking, and next thing you know, they would quit smoking. What's wrong with people these days? Why they cannot quit smoking? He gets it. He's a smart guy. He knows why it is. But it is really amazing because all these people who suffered from mild to moderate or moderate to severe forms of the illness, they've already quit. Everybody who was a moderately severe tobacco use disorder patient is out of the picture. It is so difficult to smoke cigarettes in 2017. You're treated like a second class, third class, fourth class citizen. Little kids make fun of smokers and the mother does not scold the kid for making fun of another human being. I mean, insane things. And so all these people are out of the picture. And what we're left with is this tail end, the cohort of really, really severely affected patients. Number one, they're the ones who bought themselves an evaluation for depression and anxiety. As you know, tobacco is a mild stimulant. So as a mild stimulant, it does have antidepressant and anxiolytic properties. So it may very well be that some of these patients may be still using tobacco as self-medication of some kind of depression and anxiety. And of course, we have much better interventions for depression and anxiety other than smoking cigarettes. The second thing is that if we put them on varenicline, you may very well end up having to put them on varenicline for much longer than the 3 months or the 6 months that they are now the classic indication for varenicline. You may start thinking about it as maintenance treatment. The same way that we use buprenorphine for a good 30-40% of our patients for a long, 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 long time, similarly, you may want to think about that for varenicline with your patients, and we do that. Much better idea. I know huffing and puffing around here, but a much better idea than cigarettes. Go ahead.
The warning of putting people with mental illness on the varenicline.
Ah, that's out of the window. There was an issue of increased suicidality with varenicline, but this has been completely debunked. Even the FDA took out the black box warning from varenicline. We're delighted about it. It was in the United States, it started in Philadelphia. It was very much a Me Too situation where everybody talked to each other and they say, aha, my suicidality must be because of the varenicline. Remember, these tail end people who suffer from the severe form of the illness are the ones who have a significantly higher comorbidity with depression. And of course, they would be the ones who would have higher rates of suicide attempts and suicide. Go ahead. The dreams are a problem because of the acetylcholine receptor that it gets partially activated. We do use some kind of, I do use Ramelteon, which is not a very popular drug these days, Rosarem, which is kind of like people hardly talk about it anymore. Yes, you may give a sleeping pill as well. It's a melatonin agonist.
Is it same across the board for chewing tobacco?
The treatment?
Yeah.
Yes, the treatment's the same. The treatment's the same. All right. Let's go to Adam. Pick your victim.
Ooh. Anybody back here?
There you go.
Willing?
So Adam says, I've been drinking heavily for 30 years. Every time I try to stop drinking, I get so darn irritable, anxious, and restless. I end up having a drink just so I can get a good night's sleep. I haven't used this drug, but I'm going to think a Comprose.
Correct. That's correct. That's the correct answer. Okay. Let me explain that. You drink, we do the same thing as with naltrexone. You drink for a long time. And what does alcohol do to the glutamate system? What does alcohol do to the GABA system? No. Alcohol promotes the GABA system. GABA is an inhibitory system in the brain, so alcohol promotes GABA activity and inhibits glutamate activity. So synergistically, by promoting an inhibitory system, GABA, and by inhibiting an excitatory system, glutamate, it overall suppresses the central nervous system. That's what alcohol does. So let's isolate the glutamate system here. So chronically, you've been drinking alcohol, and you have been chronically suppressing your glutamate system. How is the body going to react to the chronic suppression of the glutamate system? It's going to upregulate. It's going to make more postsynaptic receptors. It's going to make better functioning postsynaptic receptors. It's going to rev up the glutamate system to counteract the chronic inhibition from alcohol, right? And actually, the body does a fairly good job in balancing things out with the upregulation of the glutamate system. So all that's fine and good up until the time when you stop drinking. You stop your alcohol, and now what you're left behind is a hugely upregulated glutamate system that is unopposed. And that's what you see in the acute withdrawal situation. You do see high blood pressure, you see higher pulse, you see sweating, you see anxiety, all this hugely upregulated glutamate system that is now unopposed. In the first few days, that is the acute withdrawal, but as I mentioned before, it can keep on going for 3 months, 4 months, or more with a protracted withdrawal. Acamprosate interferes with the glutamate system, resets the line here, and makes the protracted withdrawal much more palatable. So if your patient falls more on the abstinence cravings side of the world, then acamprosate may be a better choice.
Does it have any role in seizure activity?
You would expect with glutamate, but it's not being used for... It's not an antagonist to the glutamate system. It has a very allosteric, complicated mechanism. That's why I chose my words very, very carefully, and I said it interferes with the glutamate system. I don't think it has been used as an anti-epileptic. I don't think so. Maybe some study somewhere, but I don't think so.
I was just thinking in the alcohol withdrawal period, putting them on it.
No, for the acute withdrawal, you absolutely need to use your benzodiazepines or gabapentin if one of these days gets approved. But no, you are not going to, acamprosate will not save you from the treatment of acute withdrawal from alcohol. That's it. Thank you for bringing this up.
3 times a day is pretty hard.
3 times a day is very hard. 666 milligrams 3 times a day. First of all, which genius thought of the 666? Catholic patients, I mean, we have like, you know, just like we could put 667 and it would have been just fine. It's just, you know, stupid. And they're huge pills as well. In my experience, acamprosate works best when the patient takes no other medications. So you can integrate a psychosocial intervention in the pharmacological one. Mm-hmm. And you can say, okay, you wake up in the morning and you review in your head the 2 things that are most important for your sobriety. I want to do it because of my kids. I want to do it because I want my independence, if you're elderly, whatever it is. And you take the 2 pills thinking about the 2 things that are most important to you. You do the same thing in the afternoon. You do the same thing in the evening. And you try to organize the person's life around those 6 pills, which is quite effective. But if you're, of course, taking already a bunch of other HIV pills and everything else, then it becomes very problematic. All right, we're almost there. Doreen, 3 more to go.
Doreen?
All right.
Doreen says, from the moment I get up to the time I go to bed, I keep asking myself, should I drink? Shouldn't I drink? It's sheer torture. I'm going with C.
No, buprenorphine has no effect on alcohol. So this is an alcohol drug. If you remember.
Oh, D, yeah.
D, disulfiram, good old antabuse. We don't use disulfiram very much in 2017 because it's a nasty drug and it is not particularly effective. But for people who are highly, highly obsessive and the question of drinking versus not drinking ravages their lives, it's a good idea. You give them first thing in the morning and there is no question anymore. They cannot drink because you cannot drink on disulfiram. Okay. All right, excellent. Let's go. Carlos. This guy looks like Carlos.
Carlos?
Here. Right here. Yes. Go ahead.
You want to do
Carlos? No. Oh, all right. Okay. Carlos was very...
Carlos says, methadone has worked well for me, but I'd rather see my doctor in her office and not have to go to the clinic.
Okay.
This I'd go with B.
That's a C now. Very good. That's a C. That's suboxone. That's buprenorphine naloxone. This is your classic opioid treatment that we do, the garden variety, 16 milligrams. 16 milligrams. We used to say 8 to 16. I think more 16 than 8 these days.
Are there ever any reasons to go up
to? Yes, very rarely. We do go to 24, but certainly no more than 24. Rarely on 24 and never more than that. And then I'm going to do the last one here. Galina says, my doctor says that I have a cocaine problem and bipolar disorder, but I know that I'm an alcoholic and my main problem is migraines. Hopefully you have figured out the system by now of the thing, and it is topiramate. Topiramate has an indication for migraines, and I'm sorry, it has an indication, yes, indication for migraines, and has some evidence of being good for cocaine, for alcohol, and perhaps a little bit of mood stabilizing properties, so you can kill four birds with one stone. Thank you guys very much, and all the best to you. Okay.